This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with John Arcto, Anglo-futurist. John, great speaking with you.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, I've seen your... I saw a bit of your podcast with Walt. Not that much, though. I know that you are keen on Castizo-futurism.
Oh, I don't think I've necessarily been promoting that, but that's what... We'll kind of, I guess, get to those topics later, but that's how Walt... That's how he named the show we did. So yeah, like I discovered you via Walt Bismarck.
And yeah,
John, if you just want to kind of like go over your political journey,
yeah, sure. Why you sure. So, I mean,
also like why you reject the dissident right and instead brace the term. I think you call it right wing progressivism instead.
Progressive rightism.
Okay.
Right, you suppose right-wing progressivism. I suppose I just use the words in a different order just to make it a bit more to separate me from people like Anatoly Karlin, I guess. So yeah, I'm John Arcto. Many of you, you know, will read my Substack or would have seen interviews of me by like Alex Kashuta or Walt Bismarck. It's quite well known now that I started on the left, became very disillusioned by wokeism, how the left had become so kind of intrinsically linked with wokeism. And then I kind of moved towards a sort of post-liberal view. And then COVID happened, which made me sort of more suspicious of government, I guess. And I slowly found my way to the distant right by, you know, listening to people like Oddifold Hirst and Rod Dreher and Ed West, and then eventually people like Chris Rufo and Aaron McIntyre. And I started Anglo-Futurist because I felt that, you know, the distant right, I've now left the distant right, I did an article on it, because I felt it was too sort of sectarian and black-pilled and sort of averse to sort of political action. So I sort of carried on with the label for a bit because I, you know, I thought Aaron McIntyre kind of was proof that you didn't have to sort of be like that to be distant right. But, you know, a bit disappointed by his recent book. And so I just think I'm not DR anymore. I like to call myself progressive right because
reactionary or right wing means preserving the status quo, and there's
exactly,
sort of
yeah,
nothing
so
left to preserve.
Exactly, that thing. So conservative means preserving the status quo. There's nothing to conserve, right? Reactionary means going back to the status quo ante. But, I mean, that just led us to where we are today, right? So, obviously, the previous state of society had some really big problems. I like to compare, you know, reactionaries to the sort of French legitimists. Yeah, because there's three types of French monarchists. There were the legitimists that wanted the pre-1789 order restored. You have the Orleanists, which you know, supported a separate branch of the French monarchy and were sort of more kind of liberal. That I'd say, you know, Orleanist, like most like normie cons would be like Orleanist. And I guess I'm a Bonapartist, which I think, you know, both Napoleon and Napoleon III were kind of right-wing progressives of their day, kind of sort of creating something new in a sort of right-wing, which I to me, right-wing just means that you acknowledge that hierarchy exists and is inevitable, whereas if you're left-wing, you believe in an ideal of equality. So I would say that, yeah, I am right-wing. But I mean, it is all relative. But
What are the tenets of your proposed Anglo-Futurist movement?
So, I mean, I say this all the time. I mean, I didn't invent Anglo-Futurism. It was a word devised by a guy called Aris Rousinos. And it's basically, it is a kind of right-wing progressivism, because it simply says we need to look forwards to creating a new Britain that, you know, is technologically advanced, offers a high standard of living, but doesn't seek to just completely replicate the past. So it's quite sort of opposed to the sort of Peter Hitchens, Roger Scruton focus on, like, tradition and sort of wanting to return to the past. Anglo-futurism is, you know, it is sort of oriented towards creating something new, but something anti-woke. And in terms of, like, what does it believe, like, on the issues, I'd say it's sort of like kind of Singapore. It's not social democracy, it's not neoliberalism, it's sort of a small government, but with a sort of competent, efficient state bureaucracy. That was how Aris Rousinos envisioned it, and I don't claim to agree with him on everything, but I've kind of taken his mantle to try and make that ideology a little bit more comprehensive and, you know, proper movement.
Does the right have an elite human capital problem?
Absolutely it does, yeah. I mean, Nathan Kofnas was bang on the money there. And it's no use Dave Green saying, like, oh, you know, the elite decides what's high status. Okay, but, you know, you can build a counter-elite, right? And to some extent, you know...
So counter-elitism is far superior to populism. Populism is...
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, I do believe in elite theory. I think it's a very helpful tool. Populism and counter-elitism need to be like a synergy.
Exactly.
So you need to have a populist movement and a counter-elite that can replace the old elites to create something substantive. Like, a great example of this, FDR, right? You know, FDR was a populist, but he also was able to, you know, create a new establishment. In my opinion, that establishment turned out to be very bad. It was clearly, you know, from an American standpoint, unconstitutional, but he did manage to launch a sort of successful populist revolution because he also had a counter-elite to help him, you know, carry his promises out.
Do you have thoughts on the upcoming British elections?
I've written quite comprehensively on it.
Of the Tories, even, like, I think now even, like, Labour is actually pivoting to the right of the Tories on immigration, which is insane.
No, I wouldn't say that's true.
But also,
I think
can the Tories be reformed, or has it just been...
Well, yeah, this is what I've been exploring. For a long time, I felt that the best approach was that a spoiler party like Reform should only stand in the Conservative and name-only Liberal wet Tory seats in a hope to kind of reshape the Conservative Party and reform it in a similar way to how the GOP was reformed. But there's a lot of, you know, on the right in Britain, so much sort of loathing of the Tories. You know, that's why you hear, you know, academic agents, zero seats, just constantly chanted out. Like, zero seats isn't going to happen. And that's partly why I was suspicious of zero seats for a long time. Because, like, you know, surely it's better to try and use this sort of popular discontent of the Tories to shape the rump, right, in a sort of more base direction. But I think the game changed when Nigel Farage returned and their polling went up a great deal. I still think it's unlikely that they will outpoll the Tories like Canada's Reform Party did the Progressive Conservatives in the 1993 election.
Oh, so it'll probably be a Labour victory, but then with Nigel...
It'll definitely be a Labour victory. It's just a question of whether Reform or the Tories come second or third, respectively.
Why do you think the Tories aggressively embraced, like, mass immigration?
Because... Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. I think part of it was due to liberal Tories, right? So, there's always been this faction of the Conservative Party that's been very accommodating to the left and always sort of adopts an essentially leftist managerial worldview. So, a comparison in America would be like the Rockefeller Republicans, right? So there's always been, that tendency. It's called One Nation, but One Nation, it was created by Disraeli, and loads of people on the right will sort of claim the mantle of One Nation. But what it really means, particularly since the 2000s, has meant a sort of liberal Blairite Tory. But I guess the more interesting question is why did those elements gain so much prominence? And I think it was because there, like in America, there was a desperate sort of attempt by the sort of Cameronites to make themselves sort of palatable to kind of Blairite polite society, which didn't work, of course. People still say, Tory scum, and the people they were trying to appeal to, never voted for them anyway. Another thing, I guess, particularly on like immigration, it's because neoliberals like cheap labour. So if you look at like the Adam Smith
Right, I
Institute.
think what I've heard is Tories are actually like in America, there's been this realignment where the working class are shifting towards the Republicans and more affluent voters towards the Democrats. But I think what I've heard, I'm not sure, you can correct me if this
We
is wrong,
almost
but
had
what
that
I've
with Boris. We
right,
almost
but what
had that
I've
with
heard
Boris.
with the UK is that actually if the Tories still actually have more affluent voters.
We almost had what you were describing with Boris Johnson. I'd like to compare Boris Johnson to Richard Nixon because I feel like he kind of played a similar sort of role in sort of making populist noises, right, and sort of starting a realignment. But in actual fact, when he got into office, both Boris and Nixon were quite liberal. Richard Nixon passed, Executive Order 11478, which sort of mandated racial quotas in federal hiring. And Boris Johnson, saw hundreds of thousands net of immigration, man, it increased to levels it had never reached before. He also was, wet on things like, abolishing the Blairite legislation, like, the Equality Act, leaving the European Convention of Human Rights that just allows the courts of allows European courts to impose on member states an ever expanding living view of human rights is always the latest woke trend, effectively. So I think, I'd like to see the Tories move in a different direction. Maybe reform will give them a, the kick up the arse they need. But loads of people have expressed severe doubt that this could ever happen, and people who have spent a lot of time in the Conservative Party, that it's really a sort of very non-ideological, sort of quite kind of it's a party of power, effectively, and not really a sort of party of ideas. So I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, really, I was talking to my friend about this. We can't really start making plans on the British front until we actually know the election results, because that will, change our approach of what we need to do going forward, whether the best approach is, go down the new party road, or whether, the reforming the Tories road is the better option.
And this touches on this sort of elite human capital question, but there is this kind of conundrum with becoming more kind of like pro-oriented and populist, because the problem is, on one hand, a lot of affluent voters favor things like mass immigration, globalization, but then shifting to a working class oriented party, you also get stuck with more anti-intellectualism, and there's downsides to that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. And I think you've got to play meta politics, right? You need to position yourself in a way to be able to communicate certain ideas in a way that doesn't off-put, you know, more affluent people. So I'll tell you a really good example in Britain, a party that has done this, the Social Democratic Party, and a man called William Clouston. When you hear him speak...
Is that the Lib Dems?
No, it's very different from the Lib Dems. They used to... Well, the old SDP merged with the Liberals to become the Liberal Democrats in the late 80s. But the modern SDP is a faction of the SDP that didn't consent to the merger. And they've been like, you know, a tiny, tiny party. But they're having a resurgence now because William Clouston has made, you know, sort of oriented them towards a sort of old left post-liberal view. And I think if you were to sort of see, you know, how can quite right-wing ideas be communicated to a more sort of intellectual audience, you know, the way William Clouston speaks is I think the way you go there.
Has Brexit been a total failure?
Oh, yes, it has. I mean, and I've written an article on this, you know, why are Britain's young people woke? And I think a big reason for it is Brexit. You know, they gain nothing from Brexit other than losing the means to travel without visas, just to the point in their lives when they were able to benefit from it.
And you know, it shifted immigration. It didn't stop immigration.
It didn't stop immigration. It was, and I think Aaron McIntyre and Morgoth did a podcast on this. You know, the whole Brexit agenda was hijacked by these kind of neoliberals that wanted it to be quote unquote global Britain, and sort of allowing sort of, you know, more non-white immigrants. And that's just been a disaster. I mean, I don't like the EU at all. I think it's terrible the way they treat countries like, you know, Hungary and Poland. I still advocate us leaving the European Convention of Human Rights, because human rights is just a dog whistle for wokeism, you know, at this point. And I just think that we need to do that. We need to actually get legislative sovereignty. And I don't like how the EU is sort of an institution which kind of imposes this sort of woke neoliberalism on member states. But at the same time, I think that the way Brexit was done was terrible.
And Farage, you would say Nigel Farage deserves a lot of blame and scrutiny.
Well, Nigel Farage, the thing about Nigel Farage, he's very charismatic, but you've also got to understand that he's a massive gatekeeper. He's actually very, very proud of this. He said, you know, I did more to destroy the BNP than any other person in Britain. So he's always sort of policing his right flank to make sure that any of his parties, whether that's UKIP or Reform, don't, you know, go beyond a sort of certain level of discourse. And certainly, you know, keep any talk of sort of the declining percentage of the white population kind of away from the mainstream. And it's funny because Nigel Farage is an improvement of over Richard Tice, right? Because at least he's got that charisma and he's a little bit more willing to sort of explore certain ideas. And sort of attack established narratives. But recently in the British election, there's Channel 4 did an expose of Reform members, showing some people saying racist comments. And there's a very high probability that one of those people who, you know, they said was a Reform member was actually a plant, because he was, you know, people looked him up, and, you know, he was an actor. But Nigel Farage has condemned that. He's called it, you know, election interference. But yet what does he do at the same time as he's doing that? Oh, he expels all of the people that said the racist comments out of the party. It's like, Reform needs to understand that the mainstream media will always call them racist.
So I think the American conservative movement has always done that, but I think now things are just beginning to change on that, where you see, like, more conventional conservative figures, like, drop the sort of, like, self-policing on political correctness, but that's a very recent trend.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, in America, though, what that is combined with is this sort of Democrats are for something, we're against it,
and it's
also
super anti-intellectual,
like,
too.
And anti-intellectual, and also, like, it's not just, like, talk about demographics and HBD. It's probably more just these wacky conspiracy theories, right? And Scott Greer made this excellent point that, yeah, it's true that the mainstream is sort of more, like, exploring the fringes and more tolerant of the fringes, but, you know, most of the fringe isn't, you know, intelligent discourse about, you know, HBD and, you know, the civil rights law. It's, you know, UFOs, anti-vax, all those kind of crazy conspiracies. And so, yeah, I think in America, you're in some ways in a better situation, but it's just the difference between sort of, you know, actually, like, good, important stuff that's on the fringes and the fringe that is made up of lunatics.
Do you have thoughts, like, with the rapid demographic change in the UK and Europe, it's different, I mean, different models might make different sense in different places as opposed to the United States, but the different models are, there's assimilationism, assimilating immigrants, there's repatriation, which is extremely controversial, but I think it's sort of like the right is talking about that more, and then there's, like, ethno-pluralism or right-wing multiculturalism, which I'm much more sympathetic to. Do you have thoughts on those three models and what you're most...
So I think I struggle to understand, right, why Americans are so worked up about Hispanic immigration, right? Because from our perspective, right, these are European descended, primarily, Christians that are often no darker in skin tone to Southern Italians, right? And so, you know, Southern Italians were able to sort of become part of the white majority group. And really, the only reason why Hispanics haven't done that is because of the civil rights regime, where there is an incentive to not be white in order to sort of get access to sort of discrimination law and all kinds of sort of special benefits. But yeah, America, I know it's sort of a bit of a neocon thing to say, but it is kind of true, particularly from a sort of British perspective. America is a nation of immigrants, right? And those immigrants were white, you know, and the core of American culture was sort of Anglo-Saxon. But, you know, it is true that, you know, I think a nation of immigrants narrative makes far more sense in America than it does in Britain. Another thing that we don't have in common with you, other than the fact that, you know, we're not a nation of immigrants, you know, the Anglo-Celtic ethnicity has been here for millennia, is that the immigrants coming are far more culturally distinct than Hispanics are to America. You know, Muslim immigration, Indian immigration, it's almost all, like, non-white. And this is partly why Brexit was such a disaster, because, you know, Polish immigrants to Britain, in a generation, they were assimilated. But, you know, when there's that skin tone barrier, even if they look perfectly assimilated on the surface, like, I'll give you an example. Black Britons, right, you know, who came over, you know, with the Windrush generation, you know, they speak English, they have sort of English names, that, you know, they're Christian or secular. But Black Britons, because of their skin tone, do not see themselves as sort of part of the same interest as the indigenous white population, and they identify more with African Americans than they do white British people. So just to sort of finish up, because I know I'm rambling a little bit, what do I think is the best thing?
Well, the three models is the repatriation, which is the most controversial.
Yeah, so repatriation,
assimilationism,
I think,
and then ethno-pluralism.
I think for repatriation of, like, sole British citizens, I think the moment's passed for
it's
that.
Way, like, I think you could say that about recent migrants, but I think it's way outside.
Yes, no, so I would be in favour of deporting all illegal immigrants.
Okay.
I would want those who have permanent residency to leave and make plans to return home unless they are absolutely indispensable. And if they're indispensable, we should be working towards as much as possible training native British people to do those jobs. And also, I'd like to restrict dual citizenship. I'd want future dual citizenship to be ended. I'd like dual citizens, you know, not having the same full rights. Like, I don't think they should, you know, stand for political office, maybe shouldn't vote. You know, if dual citizens commit crimes, they should have their British citizenship revoked. And I think if you did that, you know, the percentage of whites would increase. And also, like, a little bit of ethnic diversity is fine. You know, you have some nice restaurants, for instance, you know. But it's just when it goes above, like, 5%.
So,
you know, so a country can cope if it's, you know, 95% white and 5% non-white. I'd say that's probably the ideal. There's, you know, a little bit of sort of cultural interchange and exposure. But then if it goes beyond 5%, that's when you start having a problem.
So ethno-pluralism, where different groups have their own enclaves, you think that would lead to too much balkanization? You're not crazy about that?
Well, I mean, I think we have so many, like, Muslims that are sole British citizens, right? So I guess I'm quite sympathetic to that sort of pluralist idea. I do want Britain to remain overwhelmingly white, right? And I'm not saying that, you know, non-white or non-white should be expelled. I'm actually very pro-interracial marriage because I see that as a sort of having a bleaching effect, which will allow these sort of minority groups to gradually be incorporated into the dominant ethnicity, which, you know, most ethnats, to them, that's like treason, right? That is something which they are dead against. They see sort of racial intermarriage as like the worst thing that they want to avoid, whereas I see it as preferable to the sort of balkanization. I think we're going to kind of need a bit of all of those approaches: assimilation, a little bit of sort of pluralism. But I think for Britain, we really do need to focus on keeping this country an overwhelmingly white majority country.
Is that possible considering that birth rates are declining?
Yeah, well we're never going to be a homogeneously white country anymore unless you do like repatriating citizens. And I just think that, you know, that's just, there's no demand for that. And I don't have anything again. You know, if a non-white person is, you know, patriotically British, fine. You know, I'd rather that than they, you know, support critical race theory. But a lot of them do support critical race theory because they are ethnically predisposed towards that. So, what was your question again?
The whole issue. How do you address the whole issue? Do you think?
Yeah, the problem is that in the discourse, you know, I think net zero immigration that is reforms policy is a good policy as a starting point. But it's still deeply taboo in British politics to talk
that
about...
That just means a total moratorium.
About declining white percentage of the population. It's very taboo to talk about that. Some of our
so,
most based figures...
More so
are
than
like,
complaining about immigration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can maybe get away with saying, like, culturally incompatible... Right, you can sometimes get away with saying that. But, for instance, people who will say that will say, oh, you know, the Windrush generation was fine because they were Christians and spoke English, and you're never, ever allowed to talk about the issue of race. And a lot of the time, people like Nigel Farage will sort of praise the Windrush generation as successful immigration, which, I mean, it hasn't been. The fact that critical race theory has taken root here shows that actually it hasn't been a success.
You wrote an article advocating for Georgism, which is really interesting. And I had a guest on who I'd say was more of a lefty advocating for Georgism. And it is kind of, it's very interesting, but also coded as lefty. What is your case for Georgism, and how do you address the concerns that it could be used to erode property rights?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's very, you know, I don't oppose, you know, incorporating left-wing ideas, and I actually think that us, you know, adopting certain sorts of ideas from the left will help make us a bit more attractive to elite human
it's
capital, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And about property rights.
Well, the basis
you know, I don't
of
have
Georgism a, is a it overlaps
land
a lot
value
with the YIMBY
tax,
movement,
yeah.
But it's a land value tax.
Yeah. So about property rights, my views on property rights are not absolute. Okay. So I believe that I think private property is a good thing to exist in society, but it is dependent on that private property being utilised for the public good. And, you know, I'm not a socialist because I do believe that the market economy ultimately is better at providing the common good than, you know, totally state-planned economy. But particularly, like, land. I mean, nobody created land, right? And so I think, you know, natural monopolies, so, like, land or water or, you know... or, you know, utilities that are natural monopolies, like, you know, electricity and water supply, they should be owned in common. That's all the essence
of
them.
I agree, basically.
I'm glad you mentioned that article, because I don't get sort of asked about that very much. But yeah, I mean, economically, I am a Georgist,
and I see it as a way
to bridge divides which exist on the right on economics, you know, between the sort of Richard Hanania sort of neoliberal types and the kind of Sourab Ahmari, Michael Lind sort of, you know, economic leftism. I think Georgism is a sort of ideology which can sort of bridge that divide, because it's, you know, I don't think it's really sort of left or right, really. It sort of can be either.
I guess it's friendlier towards... It's interesting because it's sort of populist in some ways, but also friendlier towards business in other ways. But then also, like, if you own a house in a highly desirable area, then you might be pressured to sell.
Yeah.
Because you can't really... Like, Georgism would not allow to have, like, single-family zoning... in some more really highly desirable,
yeah.
Like London,
yeah, well, I believe
in
high density, in upzoning.
So like a sort of like a right wing YIMBYism.
Yeah, I am. I'm a right wing YIMBY, right? And I think YIMBYism of the kind that like Pierre Poilievre in Canada advocates is good, but I think without Georgism, you do risk having a situation that you had in Ireland, where it just becomes a speculative bubble. So yeah, I believe that YIMBYism and Georgism go hand in hand. I'd also, another big thing that I'm focused on is like tax simplification. Like, I think we should only have a few taxes, and a land value tax would be brought in gradually. So I think, you know, if it's immediately like the 100% land value tax that sort of Henry George and the early Georgist movement advocated. If you did that straight away, it would just cause absolute chaos. So, you know, we might want to get to that point eventually, but it would need to be a gradual phase in. And whilst we're phasing it in, you know, we'll sort of keep... I mean, I'm comfortable with income taxes as long as they're like flat. And also, most Georgists these days don't just advocate a land value tax, because they are the Georgist philosophy is about natural monopolies.
So there could be many different versions
and external benefits. So Pigovian taxes, like, you know, taxes which are taxing things which have a cost to the wider community. Georgists aren't opposed to,
well,
like,
big, yeah, like they're field. Really big in taxing like wasteful land use, like taxing
exactly
lots.
Yeah, which have sort of negative externalities, although I think, you know, because it's quite libertarian, a lot of these Pigovian taxes might be sort of ring fenced, so they only go to issues directly resulting from the negative externality of that economic activity. So, like, for instance, if you have like an alcohol tax, that tax would be ring fenced to go to like alcoholics rehabilitation programs, and, you know, subsidizing health funds. So yeah.
Or you could have, like, I think there's room for a lot of flexibility, so maybe, like, property taxes incentivize, like, family formation, but they disincentivize people from having just, like, large, empty, like, large homes with lots of empty rooms, like, something like that.
Yeah, I don't support property taxes because it disincentivizes development, whereas a land value tax doesn't. It incentivizes development. Yeah, personally, I'd want property taxes all replaced with land value tax, and I'd like a lot of upzoning. And it could be, I mean, a nice sort of Art Deco style, sort of like mid 20th century Manhattan would be the sort of the Georgist city, which is sort of beautiful. But another thing I'd do, right, is with my land value tax, I would allow companies that have invested in improving the overall land value of the area, I'd give them a deduction on revaluation. Like, because a problem with Georgism is, you know, the issue of revaluation, and then, like, in Estonia, it's always a big, like, issue, like, you know, when are we doing the revaluation? It's not formally enshrined by law. I'd say that in order to sort of incentivize development and not sort of lead to sort of constantly trying to, you know, reduce the value of land, I would say that companies that invest in improving the overall value of the community would get a deduction. Which would mean that they benefit from that, instead of with the revaluation happening, them having to also pay for the value that they added, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And also, would you, or making tax, corporate tax structures, would you support like a simplified corporate tax code, or maybe?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm very, very into that. I mean,
my
ideal, right, would be to have just a legal person's tax. So, in, you know, the level of income tax and the level of corporation tax is the same, but for the corporation tax, I'd do what Estonia does, which is that only the profits that are distributed to shareholders are taxed. And I'd also have you know, savings would not be taxed. So essentially, because I'm against consumption taxes most of the time, because I think they're hard to collect and they incentivize black market activity, but if you make savings tax free, well, you know, a direct income tax would effectively just be like a corporation tax. A consumption tax.
Right. You have a really interesting article about the movie Blade Runner.
Yeah, I'm really glad I came on here because you're talking to me about articles which I'm really proud of and I really like, but I never get asked on. So thank
you.
But
you always, usually always get asked about just the British politics, which
British politics, factions of the rightosphere. I never really get asked about like Georgism. And I hope that I've not been rambling. I hope that
I think we covered a lot of great subject matter, but I guess I want to go over the Blade Runner article.
Blade
Runner is supposed to be a dystopia. Well, I haven't seen the newer version, but the original film from the early 80s, which takes place in LA, I think in 2019.
It's supposed
to be a dystopia, but you say it's less dystopian than our current society. So some of the interesting points, I think what really defines like the Blade Runner aesthetic is the more kind of vintage neon signs, which are a lot more beautiful than like the current LED signs, but also the Vangelis soundtrack,
which
makes it very otherworldly and sort of, you say, techno-mystic. But then other angles of Blade Runner is, it shows a future that's very YIMBY, but at the same time, you say it's multicultural, but it's, I guess by the standards of the early 80s, it shows a rapid demographic change, but by today's standards, it shows, you'd actually say, a non-woke, white-friendly multicultural.
Yeah, it's a deep,
it also,
a deep line.
Then it also shows that Japan is a superpower, which I guess a lot of the weebs online would like.
I do make that point. I mean, multiculturalism, hypothetically, could work. The issue is with whites is that they allow themselves to be emotionally manipulated by claims of racism.
Works if they really assert themselves.
If you want to see a successful example of multiculturalism, and in that Blade Runner article, I think I do infer to it, it's Dubai, right? You know, whites are kind of at the top of society. And they sort of use immigrant labor to sort of build themselves up. But, you know, there's no pretense of equality in it at all.
Well, Dubai has, like, an explicit sort of racial caste system where it's...
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
Europe,
and
Blade
Runner kind
Arabs,
of is like that. It's like the whites
Asians.
And the whites and the Japanese are on top. And then the South Asians are the sort of, you know, laboring class. I do sort of make a lot of assumptions about the kind of society, but I love the aesthetics of Blade Runner, but it is really affected by a nighttime and drain bias, which makes it seem more dystopian than I think it would be if it was like if we saw more daylight. You
but
know
it's
what I mean?
Also ironically, it's also nostalgia for the past because it's supposed to be futuristic, but like those kinds of vintage neon signs were much more common in the past, and today they've been replaced by stuff.
It's also very film
noir nostalgia. So it is sort of
and that's great as well. You know, I like the clothes Rachel wears throughout the film,
like Art Deco super. Kind of.
Yeah, yeah, and I love
mirror,
Art Deco.
Like Art Deco, like Aztec pyramids.
Exactly.
LA.
Yeah. Honestly, Rob, I'm so glad I was asked about that article. And if anybody is listening, I would highly recommend you check it out because it is an article which I loved writing, I loved, you know, exploring, and one I just don't get asked about very much. What I've done recently with the layout of my Substack is I've created sections, so it's a bit more easy to navigate. So people can, you know, more easily access some of my older work that's just kind of been buried.
You didn't mention this movie. There's another movie with Scarlett Johansson and Joaquin Phoenix called Her, and it shows a future L.A. Ironically, it shows L.A. of the future that's super YIMBY. There's, like, skyscrapers and monorails everywhere, but it also shows L.A. as being, like, 70% white.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah.
And I can kind of think, like, what kind of policies, hypothetical policies, led to that future?
Maybe David Duke becomes president. I don't know.
But he's maybe a bit
Yeah,
too frat.
I was saying that as a joke. I don't know. I mean, I guess. I mean, I think the big thing with America is you've got to make Hispanics white. You've got to make Hispanics identify as white. That is the big thing. And also, deporting illegals, yes, and closing the border, yes. But I think the easiest thing to do is to dismantle this whole idea of Hispanics being separate from the white population, which is a new thing. It didn't exist prior to the 60s.
And you have another article, I think, forget the specific context, but you show some, like, also, like, thinking maybe more specifically about London, you have, like, some of the new buildings are more, I mean, I don't totally mind them, but they're more a bit sterile. But then you have people like
Yeah,
Roger
some of
Scruton,
them.
who want it, Roger Scruton, or even like Prince Charles, who wanted to kind of preserve London like a museum. But I think like Victorian retrofuturism
Yeah,
would be kind
and
of
I'll
like
tell you
an ideal model.
one building that I think that does sort of symbolize that is the Gherkin. That I think is one of the few new
Right.
buildings that I feel is in tune with a sort of architectural tradition. It's funny that you mention this actually because I generated some Bing images of a hypothetical alternate history and people loved it. It was like Art Nouveau, Nouveau, however it's
That
pronounced.
would probably be ideal. Like, if
Yeah, and
Victorian
people
England had
loved
the
it. You
technology of
should.
today.
Yeah, I mean Art Deco, it's perfect. It combines sort of a respect for Western tradition and also a sort of
Do you live in London?
vibrant spirit of modernity, and that I think is what is the perfect synthesis. That's what we got to do.
Do you live in London?
Just outside of London,
What do
yeah,
you
in a town
think
called
about
Guildford,
like the like brutalist,
Bromsham.
a lot of the different like brutalist high rises?
Yeah, not a fan really. I mean, yeah, particularly the sort of post-war planners sort of tearing everything down to make room for those sort of soulless blocks. But like on the other hand, the post-war housing programs were a huge success in they cleared the slums, they were able to sort of rehouse people in sort of decent accommodation. So, in that sense it was good. But yeah, aesthetically I'm really not a fan
What's
of
interesting is
them.
like 80s, like including 80s malls, like a lot of 80s postmodernism was kind of influenced by those Victorian era shopping
Yeah.
arcades.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now we're on to the topic of aesthetics. Did you read my article on vaporwave?
I ha just had that next to my outline. Does vaporwave have a reactionary power?
I think it does, and yeah, I mean that's just what I draw from it anyway.
Well, I think even going back further, so postmodernism, a lot of like I hear like Tucker Carlson has some good takes, but sometimes he's kind of backwards thinking, kind of a Philistine. I have mixed feelings on him, but he did a show where he talked about, well, he de kind of denigrated like postmodernist architecture, and actually like 80s postmodernism was actually kind of right wing because it was a rejection of modernism. And it paid homage to a lot of like ancient or classical forms of architecture. So you take something like the 80s postmodernism, you get like you borrow from neoclassicalism, but you try to make it more futuristic.
Well, thanks for enlightening me on that. I'll explore that a bit more. Because postmodernism is sort of used as an insult. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, I think, because there is a right-wing postmodernism that is sceptical of the sort of right side of history, established dogma that the woke spouts out. It's not a purely left-wing tradition. It's just that the wokeism is, I would say, like a left postmodernism. That is also in wokeism is really three things. It's sort of critical theory, intersectionality, and left-wing postmodernism. And left-wing postmodernism is sort of about deconstructing things for the sake of furthering equity and the rights of minorities. Whereas postmodernism doesn't have to be that. I mean, Nietzsche was probably a bit of a postmodernist, and so, you know, it's not a purely left-wing tradition.
It's also like deconstructionism, but like deconstructing a lot of the moral authoritarianism, because there's all these, the moral authoritarianism that puts limits on like what you're allowed to think and say, which is different than actually people say that's classical liberalism, but actually like traditional liberalism has a lot of different constraints, so to kind of, and also like, so it could be philosophical and even moral, but it could also be coming up, creating something new and exciting, but being okay, you can borrow from certain aspects of like contemporary or even like late 20th century culture to create something new and exciting.
Yeah, I mean, just to bring the conversation back to Vaporwave, I'm not alone in my assessment, because I think Richard Spencer said Vaporwave represents the last hurrah of white America.
It's sort of 80s nostalgia, but it's not recreating the 80s. It's sort of like, it's sort of like a hypnagogic dream of what the future could have been, but it's different.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I think with Gen Xers, they have like the 80s nostalgia of being like a high school student in the 80s, and kind of like, I'm at the age where, I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm at the age where maybe I experienced like the tail end of the 80s, but sort of like, I was so young that it was like a hypnagogic dream, which I think is different than just like Gen X 80s nostalgia. But I don't really, like, I'm not a reactionary. I don't want to go back to the 80s, but I want to, I like the idea of like recreating the future that should have been, like that.
Yeah, exactly. And this is partly sort of what Anglo-futurism is. Like, for Anglo-futurism, both in Aris Rousinos's original article, but also a great Anglo-Twitter poster called Bovril Gesellschaft, who wrote the prompt, the AI prompt, for a lot of the art which I've posted in his brilliant aesthetic style. It's trying to recreate the sort of post-war optimism in Britain.
Does 80s new wave music fit into this?
No, because the time scales are a little bit different in Britain and America, right? So the 80s for us was really dreary, and like the miners' strike and everything. The 60s for us wasn't this sort of, it wasn't just the counterculture in Britain. You also have like the mods. You have, you know, like the early James Bond films,
right?
To give like an example of sort of what this aesthetic is, the sort of, you know, pretty girls, you know, with the sort of straight hair, and sort of a kind of, a sort of, you know, an orientation towards the future, but still grounded in sort of the sort of heritage of Britain. That was sort of the aesthetic of the 60s in Britain, and particularly I think what Anglo-futurism is trying to recreate, because most sort of right-wing you know, ideas, right-wing aesthetics in Britain is like trying to go like Victorian, but Anglo-futurism is a little bit more like the kind of the post-war optimism. And so, yeah, the time scales are a little bit different. Like, we don't like, the 80s wasn't as good here as it was in America. But for us, ironically, the 2000s is also considered like quite a good time. Whereas with you,
because I lived there briefly in 2002.
Yeah, well, we like the 2000s, whereas you associate it with 9/11. So, And for you, the 2000s kind of marked the end of the sort of 80s and 90s age of innocence.
I do remember, well, the Cool Britannia movement era, that was, I think, maybe more than 90s.
That was more than 90s.
There was a kind of, I do remember the music. It was still kind of a lot of that, like, Eurodance music was popular.
Yeah.
I do remember it just being, like, a pretty... Even though it was, like, just after 9/11, which I know is different in Britain, but I remember it did seem like a very more optimistic...
I mean, we certainly felt it. I mean, my dad can recall where he was at the time, but I don't think it kind of changed the national mood to the degree that it did in America. Just what I've heard from Americans... 9/11 really was sort of a real cultural shift.
So the current era in Britain is, would you say, is really bleak and pessimistic?
Yes, very bleak, very bleak. I some old guy who lived through like the 70s, which where we had all the strikes and stuff. I have never known a more downbeat period of British history. It's true. I mean, it's just. We're going to get a Labour government that absolutely nobody's excited about. Like, the left isn't excited about it. You know, the right is horrified by it. But I think there's just so much disillusionment. Nothing works. You know, we're falling further and further behind in terms of our economy. Emigration's out of control. We can't do anything. The bureaucracy is utterly incompetent and just choked in red tape. It's just a very there's really not much optimism in Britain at all, which is why Aris Rausinos wrote the Anglo-Futurism, because it was an attempt to say, okay, well, yeah, the empire has gone, sure, but you know, is further and further decline really what we just have to accept, or can we carve out a new space and a new role for Britain, you know, which can give people something to sort of believe in.
We're at the end of the show. John, do you have any upcoming projects that you want to plug?
No, not really. I mean, you know, anybody who isn't already subscribed to the Substack, The Anglo-Futurist, please do. I've got more articles coming up. Thanks so much for having me on. Robbie, it was very interesting getting to discuss certain things which I often don't get asked about very
often.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear more on those types of subjects like architecture and aesthetics.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I hope we can, you know, have this conversation again sometime. And really nice meeting you. Bye.
Yeah, great meeting you. Thanks, John Arcto. Great show, and take care, everyone.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.